we do it. First of all, I'd like to thank the organisers for inviting me to speak. What I don't want to thank the organisers for, though, is only asking me a couple of weeks ago when I was about to go on vacation for a week. So, nonetheless, any errors or inaccuracies in these slides are entirely my own fault, because I have a habit of wanting to talk about subjects where I haven't fully written the paper yet. So this should be considered a preliminary version of this work. All right, so what I'm going to talk about is measures of preparation contextuality. We started this work last year at Perimeter Institute last summer because there was a big conference on the anniversary of the Cochin-Speicher theorem, so everybody was talking about contextuality. We decided to do something that was related to it, and this was this is ongoing work with my graduate student at Chapman, Eric Frieda, and David, who has just come in the room there. I'm going to talk about measures of non-locality and preparation contextuality, but let's start off with a bit of a caveat. So I'm going to attribute this to Rob Sperkins. Preparation contextuality, we know it's a resource. It can power information processing tasks. And the golden rule of trying to measure resources is basically, if you're proposing measures and you don't have a resource theory behind them, then you're basically a fool, okay? So I'm a fool or a clown for this talk, because the theory of the resource theory of contextuality, I would say, is not quite settled yet. I know people here are working on it, and there's a couple that have appeared in the literature, but the idea of fully characterizing contextuality as a resource is not really the motivation behind this talk. So let me try and explain instead what the motivation is. The motivation really has to do with experimental tests to some degree. So in quantum foundations, we tend to be pretty obsessed with inequalities. We like to test inequalities. And this goes back to the pioneering work of John Bell, who showed that you could distinguish local hidden variable theories from the predictions of quantum mechanics using an inequality, which has obviously subsequently been tested many times. And that pattern has been followed in with the example of contextuality and many other things. Right? So when somebody proposes an interesting property that that reality may or may not have, often the first thing we do is write down an inequality and then go tell some experimenters to do an experiment to test that inequality, right? An inequality test like that is basically a hypothesis test where, for example, in the case of local hidden variables, the null hypothesis is that local hidden variables are true, and you try to rule that out by violating the inequality. So you can convert basically the number of sigmas that you violate the inequality by into a p-value if you wish. And then if you look at those p-values, you find that they're extremely small, almost embarrassingly small, right? So as we'll see in a slide or so, at least one of the loophole-free tests of Bell's theorem has a p-value something like 10 to the minus 31. If you think that in other areas of science, the threshold for statistical significance is usually taken to be about 5%. That's kind of ridiculous. If you were doing a medical trial and you got a p-value that small, then probably people would say, what on earth are you doing continuing this trial? There's definitely an effect there. And when you are really, really sure that there's an effect, then what you should do is try and measure the parameters of that effect in some cases, right? So if you had, you're doing a trial of a drug and you found that that you had extremely high statistical significance, you'll probably go back to that data or try and collect new data to try and estimate the parameters, such as what's the optimal length of treatment, what's the optimal dosage, and things like that. You would try to investigate the question further. But in quantum foundations, we kind of have a habit of doing these extremely good hypothesis tests and then leaving it at that. So what I want to do really is look at measures which can easily be calculated from the experimental data and tell us something more, tell us something about the parameters of under consideration. So I'm going to take as a first example, before I get to preparation contextuality, the loophole-free Bell tests, just to show you what this looks like, just so that we have some data that we can look at. So this is the outline. So I'm first going to look at the case of loophole-free Bell tests. Then I'm going to introduce the setup for preparation contextuality. I'll spend a lot of time talking about sort of the time-like CHSH setup and a information processing task that's related to it. If there's time at the end, I'll consider some more complicated scenarios. Okay, so let's look at the loophole-free Bell tests. So as I'm sure most people are aware, there were three experiments that came out in 2015 claiming to close all the loopholes in Bell's theorem. You can convert, well, you can look at their data analysis and look at what the p-values are. Okay, so the p-values I'm reporting here, several are reported in the papers, but I'm reporting the ones for the most stringent analysis, which takes into account the memory loophole and possible predictability of the measurement settings, as well as the usual detection loophole. So the Delft experiment, which is the first one, there are now two papers, they've run it twice. The p-value of the first experiment is, well, their p-values are not that great, they're close to what's acceptable in psychology, so not that great. The main reason for this is that their experiment is extremely slow. So they have extremely high detection efficiencies. They're using nitrogen vacancy centers in diamond, but it takes them a long time to establish a single entangled state. So they don't get to collect a huge amount of data. That's why their p-values aren't that great. On the other hand, these two experiments were done with photons. It's a very, very well-established technology. They're able to create thousands and thousands of runs of their experiments, and so they get much lower p-values. Okay. Now, obviously, p-values have rather a bad reputation these days, and you know, I'm one of the people who would usually bash them. But in this case, it really doesn't matter, because if you think about the kinds of experiments we're doing, if you were trying to do like a Bayesian hypothesis test, probably everybody in this room would have a really high prior probability that the quantum mechanical predictions are true. And so therefore, if you used these likelihoods and you computed the proper likelihood ratios, you'd find that they were even smaller than this. Right? So in this case, because we have a high prior probability that there really is an effect here, then it's reasonable to report these values. Also, I should say that most people's prior probability in quantum mechanics is so high that we really should probably think of that as the null hypothesis in these tests. And then you'd get really terrible p-values. But anyway. all right. So, you know, this, especially 10 to the minus 31, right, is kind of ridiculous. Can we get anything else out of this experiment? Okay. So let's look at least one quantity that's easy to estimate from the same data. And this is fraction measures. So some of you may have heard about the contextuality fraction, which Sampson and Bransky and co-workers have worked on. But really, you can do this kind of measure for any kind of property of a probability distribution that you want to test Okay, so suppose you have some set of observed probabilities. So A is the outcome variables, X is the input variables. And here, I've just put one of each, but really it could be a long list of A, B, C, et cetera, right, in general. So you want to measure, to what extent can you think of these as being reproduced by a model which has some property Y? Y could be locality, non-contextuality, whatever you like. Then what you can always do is take your observed probabilities, try and write them as a convex combination of some set of probabilities that can be reproduced with a model that has property Y and something else. Okay, so this we don't demand that it may or may not have property Y. And then you just try to make this P as large as possible. So we define the Y fraction as the maximum of that over all such decompositions. And of course, the non-Y fraction, which is really, this thing is really the measure of the interesting thing, is just going to be 1 minus that. Okay. Now, this is kind of a crude measure, at least certainly from the resource theory point of view. But what's the most interesting thing about it is it's very simply related to inequalities. So suppose you have a linear inequality like this. So you have some function of the probabilities such that if you stick in a probability distribution which has property y, then it's bounded and it's linear. It's linear in these probabilities. Okay, this could be the CHSH inequality or something like that. Then what you can do is say, okay, well, if I compute this inequality on the observed probabilities, this quantity on the observed probabilities, then because of the linearity, I take one of these decompositions, I can just write it as P times this thing evaluated on the thing with property Y, and 1 minus P times not having property Y. Okay, now this one is, we know, is bounded by the inequality, and this one we don't necessarily know a bound on. So here we can just put in the algebraic maximum of the inequality. Okay, so that's just, you have some linear function of the probabilities. If it has a positive coefficient, if a probability has a positive coefficient, set that probability to 1. If it has a negative coefficient, set it to 0. And that will be an upper bound on what this can be. Okay, and so then you just rearrange this inequality and you find that this fraction, this the y fraction, will be bounded by this combination. And if your inequality is tight, i.e. there is a distribution that achieves it, then you will get equality here. Right? You'll be able to find a decomposition with that. So as I said before, you can consider the locality fraction, which was not under that name, but was studied by Kolbeck and Rohner, and the non-contextuality fraction as measures of this type. So just as an example of how this works, because that was a bit abstract, here's the CHSH inequality. So these are the expectation values of the variables that take values plus or minus 1. That's a linear function of probabilities, full of different settings. And we need to compute these 4 things. So the algebraic maximum, well known, is 4. That's obtained by the Popescu-Rolick box. Just basically setting all of these things equal to 1. There is a non-signaling distribution that does that. Bell's inequality tells us that 2 is the maximum for local hidden variables. And assuming that our observed probabilities are actually predicted as predicted by quantum mechanics, we know that that will be upper bounded by the Tsirosen bound, 2 root 2. And then you get that the local fraction is this thing about 0.6, and the non-local fraction is about 0.4. So if you look at an experimental test of the CHSH inequality, what you're looking for is, does it achieve a non-local fraction as high as this, or is it much lower? Okay, so now let's look at those loophole-free experiments. So the Delft experiment. So, okay, what I have to note here is I have a full statistical analysis of this still to do. What I've done so far is just taken what's reported in the papers and the supplemental materials and the data that's included in there and extracted what I can from it. What I actually need to do to get proper confidence intervals and proper statistical analysis is go back to the raw data and run a confidence interval analysis on it, which I plan to do at some point. But this is sort of a rough and ready thing from the reported values in the paper. So as you can see, Delft is getting relative. So they actually tested the CHSH inequality, and they're getting sort of halfway there to what you would expect as the maximum on locality. In Vienna, it's really bad. right? So previously, when we looked at p-values, it looked like the Delphi experiment was terrible and the Wiener experiment was great. And from this point of view, it's the other way around. And the reason why theirs is so low is for two reasons. First of all, they use a different inequality, which has a larger, which has a much lower maximum. And the reason they use that inequality is because their detector efficiencies aren't that high. They're not high enough for the CHSH threshold. And really, the lowness of this value has everything to do with the detector efficiency. So in Vienna, and also in the NIST experiment, which I haven't analyzed in so much detail, really a lot of the counts are being lost, but they have to be included in the data analysis. And of course, counts that are lost could be perfectly local, right? So that's why this non-local fraction is so low. Okay, another thing that you might be interested in is the rate of non-local bit production. At least if you're interested in how useful are these things going to be for protocols, this is going to give you a rough and ready kind of estimate. It's not tuned to any specific protocol for using non-local bits, but it's sort of just an estimate of sort of roughly how much non-locality are you generating per unit time. So just take the non-local fraction and a time for each run of the experiment and calculate that, and then you find that Vienna wins again. But still, if you think about this as a bit rate for some protocol, it's not great. So the reason here is that Delft's experiment is very slow. Even in the updated version, they're getting about 300 runs of the experiment in about a month, whereas Vienna's getting like about 3,000 in an hour or two, right? So that's the reason that balances out this huge difference in these values. So anyway, I mean, the whole point of that analysis is just to show you that we don't need to restrict ourselves to just doing a plain hypothesis test, and it's probably a good idea in these sorts of experiments to report actual parameters which may be of some use. And this is like really the same motivation behind what I'm trying to do with preparation contextuality as well. Preparation contextuality can also be tested with inequalities, and people here have done a lot of work on that. And if you were to look at the experiments on that as p-values, they would be probably even smaller than these ones, because there's no need to have locality, so the experiment can be very high quality. So there's really a motivation to try and get good parameter estimations from the data. Okay, yeah.
This focus on rate of non-local bit production does seem to have the flavor of trying to understand non-locality as a resource.
Yeah, it does, but you see, the thing is, what would you really want to study? You'd want to study something like, if you're doing device-independent cryptography, you might want to study, for example, the number of secret bits that you can generate per second. And that then the thing that you put up here won't be as simple as that, because you can't just sort of sit. It would be lovely if we lived in a world where you could sort of somehow, there was a protocol to sort of siphon off this part of the distribution and then use that. But that's not how the protocols work, because there's no way of distilling to that. I mean, that will have more non-locality typically than you started with. So that's not how the privacy amplification and so forth work. That's why I said it's kind of like a rough and ready estimate of the kinds of rates you might expect. But it's, you know, you have to do more to actually calculate something relevant to a particular protocol. And that thing more would probably involve doing more experiments, not easily estimatable from the data we have. Maybe, I'm not sure about that. Okay. So I don't want to move on to the main topic. How am I doing for time, by the way? Okay, preparation contextuality. So just for those of you who aren't so familiar with this, I'm going to give the definitions quickly. So we're going to consider experiments which consist of a preparation device followed by immediately by making a measurement. So you have some choice of preparations, which we label P. You should think of these as operational descriptions, just telling you what to do in the lab. list of instructions of what to do in the lab. And similarly for the measurement. The measurement has some finite valued random variable as its outcome. And then if the experiment happens to be one that we're modeling in quantum theory, then to each preparation, you'll associate some density operator. To each measurement, you'll associate measurement operators, a PAVM in general, and you will calculate the probabilities according to quantum mechanics in that case. Now, in an ontological model, we want to say instead that the system has some real objective physical properties that we don't know, and these are responsible for the correlations that we observe between the preparations and measurements. They're mediated by whatever the real physical properties of the system are. We call those lambda. They're also called ontic states. And basically what happens when you make a preparation P is that this exerts some influence on what lambda is, but doesn't control it fully. So each preparation corresponds to a probability measure over lambda. And these measurement devices, they respond to lambda somehow. So a measurement corresponds to a conditional probability distribution like this. So here's an example for the two outcome measurement, a measurement with two outcomes. Then for each value of lambda, there's a probability of each of the two measurement outcomes. And for each value of lambda that has to sum to one, for those to be well-defined conditional probabilities. And then the ontological model, what it says is the predicted probability is you take these conditional probabilities, you average them over your uncertainty about lambda, and that's what you'll observe. Now, of course, if your ontological model is you want the ontological model to reproduce the experimental outcomes you observe, you might also want it to reproduce the predictions of the quantum model, and those would have to be equal. Okay, so that's the general setup, sort of supposed to be very similar to the kind of setup that you use to talk about Bell's theorem and so forth. Here's the more formal definition for those of you who like formal mathematical definitions. I'm not going to dwell on it. The point of the story is that we have some set of states of reality called the ontic state space. It has to be a measurable space because I want to put probabilities on it, so it's got some sigma algebra and so forth. Preparations correspond to probability measures. Measurements correspond to these conditional probability functions, and we obtain the observed probabilities by averaging. So that's just the same thing a bit more formally. All right, so now what's the notion of preparation contextuality? This was introduced by Rob Speckens. So first of all, we introduce a notion of operational equivalence. So two preparations are called operationally equivalent if for all pairs of measurement and outcome of the measurement, we find that we get the same probability. So in other words, once you've prepared either P or Q, there's nothing you can do in the lab, no measurement that you can make, which will tell those two things apart. Okay. And of course, if we're dealing with something which is modeled in quantum theory, then if it happens that the density operators associated to those preparations are the same, then they will be operationally equivalent, same state. Now we say a model is preparation non-contextual if whenever you have this operational equivalence, then you have the same probability measure. This is sort of saying that the reason why we can't tell these two things apart in the lab is because really on the level of reality, they're the same thing, okay? If that were not the case, it doesn't have to be the case, but if it were not the case, then somehow you'd suspect some sort of conspiracy because there are two things which are distinct, and yet the thing that we need to distinguish it is somehow missing from our theory. We're unable to do it. And it seems that you would need to explain that. So the most natural explanation for why two things are operationally equivalent is that they are actually the same. But if that fails, then the model is called preparation contextual. Okay. All right, so now let's talk about measures. So first of all, we know a fair bit about preparation contextuality now. Speckens in his original paper showed that even a model of a qubit has to be preparation contextual. But the question is, how much preparation contextual. And obviously one simple thing to do is to just do the same thing that we did for non-locality using our general construction and define the preparation non-contextual fraction, which is just the maximum P in such a decomposition where this this probability distribution is can be modeled by non-contextually. So, and then we get the preparation contextual fraction by taking 1 minus. Okay. So as before, we can use our general construction. We have inequalities. If you have a preparation non-contextuality inequality like this, then you would get this formula like we had before in the general case. So that's one thing you can always do, and it's easy to estimate from any inequality violation you have in the lab. However, it's a rather crude measure. It's not, as I was discussing with Rob, it's not the most operationally meaningful thing. So we also want to consider more operationally meaningful measures that will tell us more fine-grained information about specific operationally equivalent preparations and will actually turn out to be related to information processing tasks. So those other ones that we want to consider are overlap measures. So here's the simplest case. So if I have two operationally equivalent preparations, then we can define what I'm going to call the ontological overlap. It's this. But if that's confusing, look at the graph. So suppose these probability measures are represented by these two densities, probability densities, then what this thing is really just the joint area under both of the graphs, right? That's what this thing is. And so basically, if you had a preparation non-contextual model, these would be the same distribution. This overlap would be 1. And basically, how small it is telling you something about how preparation contextual it is. Okay. Now, this has an operational meaning which is useful, which is the following. So this function of the overlap, so if somebody either does preparation P or Q with 50-50 probability, doesn't tell you which, and then somehow you learn the value of lambda. This you can't do by making a quantum measurement, but somehow, I know, God tells you what lambda is on this particular round of the experiment or whatever. Then this is the probability of successfully guessing whether P or Q was prepared. Okay, so it's linearly related to that. This has a well-defined operational meaning. Okay, so the next one I'm not going to dwell on so much. This is just the generalization of that, of this to n preparations. So if you have n operationally equivalent preparations, I can consider the joint overlap of all of them, which again would be 1 in a non-preparation non-contextual model. But I'm not going to dwell on this because I'm only going to look at it right at the end of the talk, if at all. Probably there won't be time. Okay, so now let's get to this time-like CHSH setup. I can define this setup abstractly, but for concreteness, this is what these are the states and measurements I have in mind in the Bloch sphere. So there are 4 preparations, which I'm labeling by 2 bits, and they're just so this angle here and this angle here are the same. So they're these symmetric states like this, and I'm going to measure in these 2 bases. Okay. Now, an equal mixture of this guy and this guy is the same state as an equal mixture of that guy and that guy. They both should be the maximally mixed state. So if I define these 2 mixed preparations, and this convex combination here means just do this with probability half and this with probability half, P plus and P minus are both preparations of the maximally mixed state and hence operationally equivalent. Okay. So in this setup, Speckens and co-authors proved that there's an inequality that a preparation non-contextual model must satisfy. And it's basically, it is just a CHSH type of inequality written in a slightly different way, but it's kind of the same as what you get in a CHSH inequality. So that's bounded by 6, algebraic maximum is 8. We just set all of these probabilities equal to 1. And then for this set of states, you can compute what you get in quantum mechanics, just that. And then you can just stick in that into this formula and find that you, what your preparation non-contextual fraction is this, or the preparation contextual fraction is this guy here. Okay, so as you might expect, anybody who knows about this, the optimal case is going to be when theta equals pi by 4. This is like the measurement settings in the CHSH inequality. And there you get this 0.6 and 0.4 again, which is the same as what we got with CHSH, and it's not an accident. Okay, so that's all very well. But now I want to see if we can say anything about the more operational meaningful quantity, which is the overlap between these different preparations, different equivalent preparations. Now, there's a very good reason why I chose these to be symmetric here, which is that we need to, if we have a situation that's symmetric like this, so in this case, we have a symmetry of reflection through the center of the Bloch sphere, then in that sort of case, I can show that the overlap is actually equal to the preparation non-contextual fraction. So I'm going to briefly outline that because I don't think I'll have to, the details sort of get a bit hairy, but I'll briefly outline it. Okay. So first of all, I'm just going to introduce some notation. So the measure corresponding to preparation PJK, I'm just going to call mu JK, avoid writing P's all the time. And similarly, plus or minus for P plus, P minus. Probably should have said this, by the way, but there's a reason for this notation, P plus and P minus. If I look at the two bits here, P plus corresponds to the case where the bits have even parity. So they are both zero or both one. And P minus corresponds to odd parity. That's why, that's just the reason for that. Okay, so we want to compute this guy. Now, if you take mu plus and mu minus and you decompose them like this into, with some probability, a probability distribution that's the same for both, which is what you'd expect in a non-contextual model, plus something else, if you maximize that, if you maximize this P, then you'll find that these two guys don't have any overlap. And when you then stick this into this formula, you'll find that you get out P in that case. So the maximum P here is just this overlap, but that doesn't mean that P is the non-contextual fraction. Why is that? Because, well, for the non-contextual fraction, I require that all the distributions, not just these mixed ones, but the ones corresponding to each of these four, can be written as P times something non-contextual plus 1 minus P something arbitrary. Right? So if I do have this, then I'll clearly have a decomposition like that, but not necessarily vice versa. Okay, so by this being non-contextual, I mean it satisfies the requirements of operational equivalence. But what you can, all you can actually infer from the from this decomposition is something like this. I can decompose each mu jk into a convex combination of the part that contributes to this factor and the part that contributes to the to this factor. But those probabilities don't need to be the same for each jk. And then the fact that these guys are obtained by 50-50 mixing these guys, all you can conclude from that is this relation. Now, if for any allowed p, there always exists another model with the same p, such that all of these p's here are the same, or in particular, just if P00 equals P11 and P01 equals P10, then we would be back in this case, and that would be the preparation non-contextuality fraction. And that's basically where we have to use the symmetry to show that you can construct such a model. So here I'm just going to sort of sketch what goes on. Basically, what we can do is flip everything through the center of the Bloch sphere, by which I mean I'm going to construct a new model in which what was mu 1 1 in the previous model is mu 0 0 and vice versa, etc. Similarly for all the measurement things. Because the quantum predictions are invariant under this change, the new model will reproduce the predictions as well. So then what I want to do is just, in some sense, take a mixture of these two models. So with 50% probability, use the original model, and with 50% probability, use the tilde model. And that will have the effect of averaging out these probabilities here. So the new P00 will be a half P00 plus P11, and they'll both be the same. That's basically what happens. And I don't want to belabor the details, but there's a construction which you might call the direct sum of two ontological models. Preparation contextuality in the lab, I'm not going to be able to create exactly these four states. So if there's some errors in the states I create, and I take 50-50 mixtures of them, they're not going to be precisely the same. They're not going to both be precisely in the maximally mixed state. And so I won't have the operational equivalence. I need to derive the inequalities and so forth. So basically for this setup, Matt Pusey showed in the paper how to deal with this, which is, you know, suppose I actually prepare, suppose I actually prepare these four things, then it's not true that a 50-50 mixture of them is operationally equivalent, but you can infer just from the data that you've observed that there exists a preparation, two preparations that are operationally equivalent. The basic idea is, well, use operational equivalence on that, the thing that's inferred from the data, rather than the 50-50 mixtures, and then you do the analysis. So you could do that here too, and for the preparation non-contextual fraction, that would be perfectly fine, but it's not going to work for the overlap measure, because to derive the overlap measure, we needed the symmetry. So if you want to take real data and derive a model on the overlap, then basically you've got to fit in, a quadrilateral here, which is symmetric under reflection through here. So you've basically got to optimize over all such things and then do the Poussy plane of analysis on that. And that's going to say that if you did this with real experimental data, the overlap that you get would end up being larger than what you would naively expect. Right? So unless there's another way to bound the overlap, you're going to get worse overlaps from experimental data than you would just for the fraction. That's just really a comment for the people who care about these robustness things. Okay, let's see. So now I want to talk a bit about information processing tasks that are based on this. So Speckens, in the paper where these inequalities were introduced, introduced a task called parity oblivious multiplexing, which is basically powered by this preparation contextuality effect. And it's relatively easy to see how it's related to what I've just talked about. So the task is this. So Alice has two bits, right? She has both A0 and A1, and they are both chosen uniformly at random. So she has a two-bit string, and there are four possibilities. She gets each with probability 1/4. She then has to send a message to Bob, and the property that this message should have is that it contains no information about the parity. Okay, so this should already seem a bit familiar, because if you think of these as labeling Alice's bits, then the fact that these two mixtures in quantum mechanics mix the same thing means that if I were to send those states, Bob would not obtain any information about the parity. Okay. So then Bob is going to be asked to guess either A0 or A1. So 0 or 1 is going to be chosen uniformly at random by somebody else. He's going to say, Bob, tell me what AJ is. He's going to output a guess, and he succeeds if B is equal to AJ. So this is basically the success probability here, and it's very closely related to the contextuality inequality that we had before. The classical success probability is bounded in the same way as a preparation non-contextual model is. The classical success probability is 3/4, which happens when you just, the optimal strategy, or an optimal strategy, is for Alice to just send one of the two bits to Bob. And if it happens that Bob is asked to guess that bit, then he'll get it right with 100% probability. If he's asked to guess the other bit, then he'll get it right with 50% probability. So overall, 3/4 probability of success. But quantum mechanics, it looks again like the CHSH type of value. You get 0.85. However, you want to make this kind of idea again experimentally robust, because if you try to do this by sending quantum states, then again, it's not going to be the case that that the states that Alice sends contain absolutely no information about the parity. Experimental errors will ensure that it's possible for Bob to extract a tiny amount of information. You might think, okay, well, I'll robustify this protocol by doing the MAP-Poussy thing. But you can't do that, because the MAP-Poussy thing is based on inferring the existence of operational equivalences from the data, but you never actually set the thing sent to Bob doesn't have that operational equivalence. You need to know in advance what probabilities to mix with, and you only infer that after the fact here. So to robustify parity oblivious multiplexing, you can't do that in the same way. But you can just do it by changing this in a fairly trivial way. Change it to parity epsilon multiplexing, which means that the message sent to Bob should allow him to guess with probability at most epsilon. So You can guess the parity with probability at most epsilon. Epsilon equals a half corresponds to the parity oblivious case. Okay, and then the success probability is the same sort of thing. Now, this is related to the overlap, because where was the operational interpretation of the overlap? Yeah, here, right? So this has the interpretation of the success probability of guessing, of distinguishing between P and Q. So if you think of your classical protocol as basically an ontological model, then this quantity determines what epsilon in your classical model Bob can guess with. So the fact that we can calculate this, and there's also another fact which is important here, which is that you can always make your protocol symmetric in this case, because you only care about the success probability. So if you have an asymmetric protocol, just flip everything and do the mixture, and you'll have the same success probability. So it's again a case, where we can infer from the violation of the inequality exactly what this overlap is, and hence what this probability of success is. You can do that whole analysis now, and it's not very, it's very straightforward. You just get something linear. So the classical success probability is now this. So again, for the oblivious case, we'd have half here, so it reproduces the 3/4, it's just linear. Now, we haven't, as I said, this is a work in progress. We have to now optimize the quantum protocol for epsilon, right? So all we know is the optimal quantum protocol for epsilon equals a half, the oblivious case, which gives you this value. But actually, as you increase epsilon, you should be able to do better quantumly as well. So you get some curve quantum mechanically, which we haven't figured out yet. So it's possible that you get a quantum advantage all the way up to until epsilon equals one. Wouldn't be surprised by that. But at least we know that, you know, if you allow some small epsilon, if you're allowing some information about the parity to leak, then you can still get a quantum advantage up to epsilon equals 2√2 with what we know exists. Just from these results. Okay, so I'm nearly done. And I only have a few minutes. So you can also analyze more complicated setups. This isn't the only one, but the sort of natural thing to go to next is this, what's called the, so in the non-locality case, this is called the chained null inequality setup. But here, we're just doing preparations that are equally spaced around the equator of a Bloch sphere, and the measurements are just shifted. So this diagram is this one rotated by half the angle between P1 and P2 here. Okay, so Kolbeck and Renner have a result for the non-locality case. You convert it to preparation contextuality. That gives you the preparation non-contextual fraction will go to zero as the number of preparations goes to infinity. And this protocol has the exact same type of symmetry that we had before. They might think, oh, well, I can get an overlap bound out of it. And you can. But the overlap bound is this, which, as I remember, you remember, I did briefly say you can generalize the n-way overlap. Now, this doesn't have a great interpretation in terms of information processing tasks. I'm sure you could come up with something kind of contrived. I'm not exactly sure what to say about this, but at least I can show that something's zero. That's kind of all I want to say about that. So that's to conclude, I guess my input, I started by saying that basically when you have extremely compelling hypothesis tests, you should move to estimating parameters. And it doesn't have to be difficult. You can estimate some very simple parameters from the same data that you use to do the hypothesis test. And that leads to, I think, for the Bell tests, quite an interesting comparison of which experiments are better than others. So I think that we could develop a set of metrics which quantify different parameters of Bell correlations, meaningful ones, and we should be trying to report those, and that will be how we can track experimental progress in Bell tests. For the preparation contextuality case, we were actually able to estimate some even more operationally meaningful ones, and this can be used to sort of robustify information processing tasks, which are based on preparation contextuality. So I think there's probably a lot more to do there. So I'm not going to read out these open questions, but these are some obvious follow-up questions to this kind of work, and I think I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Sure, two comments. So okay. Firstly, what you have referred to as a local fraction, I guess in our community it's more commonly referred to as local content, and more already back in 2006, there was a paper by Chairman John and Stefan Hong,
okay,
who put out an inequality like a kind of show.
Right.
That's the first one. The second one is that actually beyond just those kind of hypothesis testing that you were talking about, you could also do hypothesis testing at the quantitative level, like saying that what is the chance that the local fraction is upper bounded by some,
yeah,
or
but
upper
that's,
by some.
That's basically a confidence interval, and that's what
yes,
I'm talking
you
about.
You can turn that into confidence.
Yeah,
so what I'm trying to say is that you can also do parameter estimation with confidence interval.
Yeah. That's what I'm talking about doing, and that's what I want to do with that data,
right,
ultimately. But I haven't dug into the actual data sets yet to do that.
You mentioned that here to compute the quantity, you use symmetry that you already have in the setup. But sometimes if you don't have the symmetry, you can say, well, there is a free transformation that brings me from a non-symmetric setup to a symmetric setup, and then I can compute, of course, because the symmetrization is not one-to-one, then
yeah,
only have a lower bound, upper bound, and some quantities. Have you thought of using that?
Yeah, and I think that's probably the case here. I mean, if you look at what's sort of going on in the... I mean, if you look at what's going on with the symmetrization of the ontological model, that's sort of precisely what's going on. That kind of thing of mixing two models where you're just relabeling outcomes should be a free transformation. So yes, you could probably, yeah, if you took the four arbitrary preparations, you could probably symmetrize it by mixing them, and that would give you some sort of bound.
We generalize the epsilon error case. I didn't follow. There's a few things. Like when you allow for a failure of the operational equivalence, right, so you can distinguish the two parities with some probability, then because non-contextuality is an inference from an operational equivalence to some fact about the ontological model, how does the assumption of non-contextuality have any implications in this context? Like you need some operational equivalence to act on.
It doesn't, but from the analysis, in any ontological model, without any preparation non-contextuality assumption, the amount of weight on a non-contextual part tells you how well you can distinguish, right? So I'm not assuming anything about the ontological model, but if I just happen to write it as a convex combination of something that is non-contextual and something that isn't, this already tells me how well the parity can be distinguished.
But how can you even talk about the non-contextual part of an ontological model when you don't have any operational equivalence to be able to
Well, okay, it's not an operational equivalence, but there's a 50-50 mixture of the one parity and a 50-50 mixture of the other parity, right? They correspond to some preparations, right? And I can say, okay, let me demand that with probability P, those correspond to the same distribution, even though there's not an operational equivalence, I'm going to demand they correspond to the same. That's sort of what I'm calling the non-contextual part in this case. And with probability 1 minus p, they don't. And then when I optimize that, that tells me what the probability of distinguishing those preparations is, right? So, I mean, it's probably right to say that this breaks the fact that it's powered by preparation contextuality in a formal sense, but still somehow related to it in a way that, you know. So I think in this case, it sort of looks to me that like the robustification of the information processing class versus the robustification of the foundational question just go in different directions. So maybe there's something to think about here, like, to what extent do you need preparation contextuality to reproduce this kind of result as well? It's not entirely clear right now. But anyway, it's using the same mathematical techniques as you use to quantify the preparation.
So could I summarize what you just said this way? That if I have operational non-equivalence, I could think of that as with probability p, they are operationally equivalent, with some remainder, they're not. And then the operationally equivalent part gets, under the assumption of non-contextuality, gets represented by the same distribution, something like that.
Maybe it may be able to state it that way. Yeah.
Then it would be kind of a variant notion of non-contextuality, where you sort of, it's a way of contending with operational non-equivalence, sort of break it up into.
I wouldn't say it's necessarily a variant. I mean, probably you could just derive it from the usual notion. I have to think about that a bit. I didn't really think about this. You know, we had the measures, and then I said, okay, what can I say about the protocol from those measures? And that's basically as far as it goes. But sounds right that you can probably maybe derive that kind of decomposition from preparation.
Well, was that another follow-up?
Yeah.
Quick follow-up.
Yeah, I'm tempted to ask one question. So, can you go back to the conclusion?
Yeah.
Or the open...
Yes.
So this fraction that you were talking about, do you have any idea concerning the last question?
The last two here?
Yeah, like what kind of resource theory would make this quantity a monotone?
So I'm going to say, like, ask Rob, because I know that the group here are working on a resource theory for Beckenstahl contextuality.
Yeah.
And, you know, although we're supposed to do things the way around where we define the resource theory first, it would be very surprising if this kind of thing wasn't if these kind of things weren't monotones under it. I would say, I don't think that paper's come out yet, but ask Rob or David, or are you working on it?
Somebody.
Random members of Rob's group in the Institute will be able to tell you something about that.
Thanks.
Well, where are the old adage that bears only attack you if you get between them and their children? Academics only attack you if you get between them and their coffee. So we should take a break now, I think. But let's thank Matt again.
Thank you.